I'm Rabbi Hesse Reichman, and I'm welcoming you to the Hanukkah Shir, which we have. And when we scheduled it, we didn't know that the Hanukkah concert party would be taking place up at the yeshiva tonight. And the way it worked out, that's, I imagine, is the main reason for our reduced numbers. But Chashmanoyim, Hanukkah, were Ma'atim. There were not a lot of people. Goes to show that it's not in the numbers which counts, but rather the quality and the dedication. So those of us who came tonight, despite the concert at the yeshiva, certainly show the right dedication and the spirit of the Chashmanoyim. I want to talk a little bit about some of the, I guess you would call the messages of Hanukkah, and some of the insights that we have into it. And it is important to do, not just because we do this always in the Jewish holiday, but actually it is a mitzvah to really delve into the Nes of Hanukkah and the meaning of it, because as we see in Hadlokat Neirot, when we light the candles, we make a special bracha, Sha'asim Nisim La'av Seim, Yom HaMizman Hazeh, which that blessing is supposed to mean that the miracle means something to us. So clearly we have to delve into it. And in fact, if you look in the halacha of the Rambam, in the very first few halachot in Hilchot Hanukkah, he actually goes through the history of the situation and exactly how it developed, which apparently is in halacha as well. Actually, from halacha we know that we are supposed to really understand the context of what was going on. So clearly it's a very special part of our mitzvah to talk about what's going on in Hanukkah, to analyze the clash between the Ivanim, the Greek Syrian culture at the time, and the Jewish culture at the time. Now the Rambam writes, and it's very clear, and as we say in Al Nisim, that there was a religious clash. As he writes in the Mishnah Torah, "Kidlut atam, lo himichu otam lasot b'torah b'mitzvot." The Yevanim stopped the practice of the religion, did not allow the Jews to study Torah into the mitzvot. And we say to the davening, "Amdan malchut yavan hashalam chisel as tukam torotech al yavan chukim tzonecha," that they wanted the Jews to stop studying Torah and to stop doing the laws. Now I saw, basically most of the ideas I'm going to be saying tonight come from the Sefer called Shem Shmuel, which is a Sefer written by the Rebbe of Sofotchov about the turn of the century. And it contains a lot of Hasidic and other kinds of ideas. And he points out the fact is that here we speak in our prayers, "La'aviram mechukei v'tzonecha chukei." The word chukei, traditionally there is a difference between chukim and mishpatim, which I'm sure all of you are well aware of. Mishpatim are laws which make sense, common sense laws, and things like not to steal. Things which until very recently were common sense to say. Not to lie, not to perjure yourself on the road. So these were common sense laws. Then there are chukim, which are laws over and above rational thinking. And there are quite a few of them once we start thinking about it. And the Yevanim has special antagonism against the chukim. "La'aviram mechukei v'tzonecha." And as we go through various sources of what those gzeirot, those decrees were, they really did focus on chukim. For example, kashrut was something that the Yevanim, and as they had their Jewish allies, the Mityavnim, opposed kashrut. The laws which we emphasize ourselves, the clash about Tum'ah, that at that time, the time of Beit HaMikdash, because of Truma were a very, very big part of Jewish life, especially the life of the Jews in Yerushalayim. You go today and you look at some of the archaeology in Yerushalayim and you notice that the city was built, the ancient city of Yerushalayim, when they had a Beit HaMikdash, was really built architecturally in a way to protect the Tahara, because the streets, the ground below the streets are hallowed. You've seen by the Kotel, the Romi, also the Maharavi, that they're doing the dig, you can see that they would build below the street hollow arches to stop Tumat. They would rest there, be a mate, a dead body, someplace buried, so that Tumat goes straight up. But if you have a hollow archway between the mate and the person above, so that's an ohel. And the ohel is chotzeit, it stops the Tumat from rising. So therefore people could walk in the city of Yerushalayim without any fear of them stepping over an unknown body, and because of the hollow area below the street, which is an ohel, which is a sort of like a tent, which is chotzeit, stops the Tumat. And so the laws of Tumat Tahara were very important. Also, if you ever go into the burnt house or some of the other places in Yerushalayim, you notice that there's a predominance of vessels made from the stone, which are not the Kabel Tumat, not the Kamsame. That's why stone is a very great industry in terms of Kalim and so on. So the laws of Tuma was something that the Yevanim were very much against, and they particularly made sure to try to make things Tameh, which is the mace of Hanukkah is regards around that. The Gilu Arayot, the laws which we referred to prohibited marriages, was also something which they were particularly against. Of course, the intermarriage laws were something which they were very upset about. You know that they had their own ideas of marriages and sexual partners and so on. They had homosexuality was a very accepted form of life for them. So the Gilu Arayot laws of Judaism was something also which they were very much against. And these are the chukim. Basically, these laws are not so rational. For example, if you look into Gilu Arayot, you see that, for example, an ant. So, an ant through marriage is prohibited if it's on the father's side, my father's brother's wife. But if it's on my mother's side, through marriage, my mother's brother's wife is fine. So there's a lot of arbitrary distinctions in the halachot of Gilu Arayot. Example, a sister-in-law from another example, a sister-in-law from my brother's wife is prohibited even after he dies. However, if there are no children, I should marry her. So you have a mitzvah people on the other side. If my wife has a sister, it's only prohibited as long as my wife's sister is alive. As long as my wife is alive. If my wife thought to pass away, then my sister-in-law will be permitted with or without children or anything like that. So there's a lot of differences between things that seem to be the same. So the chukim of Gilu Arayot is something also which the Yevanim and the Avnim were very much against. And then the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash and the choice of one spot on earth to be the spot where, so to speak, God puts his presence was also something which they, and especially for one nation, this nation, something which they objected to very much. You know, that they had a pantheon where they thought that there were many gods, and gods could be all over the world, in this area, in that area, and there's no reason to limit one god to one nation, to one place. So this whole concept of Bechira, of choice, that God chose a certain spot, that God chose a certain people. All of this was something which was anathema to them. And really, I once, many times, heard Rabbi Soloveitchik discussing the foundations of Greek philosophy versus Torah philosophy and logic. He felt that the Greeks predicated their system on what we call the excluded middle. Their system of logic accepted truth or falsehood. Something was either true or false. It could not be at the same time true and false, or maybe true, maybe false, or maybe partially true, partially false. It was either true or false. And that was something which I thought fit very nicely into the human mind. People like this way of thinking. And Chukim don't really fit into that because the classic example of a chok, say paraduma. Classic example of a chok, paraduma. It makes certain people tahor, it makes other people tameh. So dealing with the same ashes makes some people tameh, some people tahor. It's a paradox. So paradoxes were things that the Greek logic and philosophy did not like. And Judaism is full of paradoxes. It's full of contradictions, which are there, which are explicitly there, like the paraduma. And we go through the halakha and Torah, we find many paradoxes. God is discussed in masculine terms as well as feminine terms, I would say. Masculine, but at the same time, Shechina, which is feminine. God sometimes is referred to as many, most often in the singular, but sometimes there's a plural. Elohim is Rashi points to that. So there's a lot of things in Judaism which involve paradoxes and some arbitrary kinds of things which the Greeks didn't like. And this is why they were Habiram Mechukei Ritzonecha. Greek thinking did not want to have a system, a competing system, which had Chukim, which had things which were beyond or outside the logical system. There was great respect, actually, between Greek philosophers and Torah scholars, which is recorded at least in our sources. We know that when Alexander came to Israel, and he was very much welcomed by the Greek, by the local rabbis, primarily the leading rabbi at the time was a Kohen Gadol named Shimon HaTzadik, who was at one point in the student of Ezra. The name of what was the prophet himself, Ezra, and Shimon HaTzadik was his student, and he was Kohen Gadol. And Shimon HaTzadik greeted Alexander at the gates of Yerushalayim, and they fell in love with one another. Mara says that Alexander said, "You are the man I see in my dreams. You're the person who tells me so many things and leads me in my way to battle and gives me my success." And in fact, the Jews of the generation decided to name all the babies that year by the name Alexander. That's why they have a Jewish name called Alexander for today. So originally, there was apparently a very great mutual respect, which then deteriorated over time, after one or two generations, when things became Antiochus type of situation. Now, the concept of chukim, of I think this is above seichel, or above logic, is something which is very trying in actually in the Torah. It's a very important concept which we have. And basically, we have a duality in Torah between the moach and the lev, between the mind and the heart. Whereas the mind works in these sort of what we call logical constructs, but the heart, what we call the lev, or the will, does not necessarily and quite often works contrary to logic. People are in love, for example. It's rarely is it the logical thing. And that, I think, is one of the problems that we have, is because we would like that to be logical so we could deal with that in an easier way, a healthy situation. But love is an illogical thing in most cases. Whether it was Yaakov's love for Rochel, love at first sight, other situations of love, say David and Yonatan, who were so devoted to one another, and they were really, as Shaul said, this was an illogical devotion, because David and Yonatan, logically, should have been the greatest competitors. Why should David and Yonatan be the greatest of friends? So this was an illogical attraction which they had to one another. And we say that this is really a pattern of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that God Himself does not act only in logical ways. For example, you know, the famous story of Rebbe Akiva, who was martyred, and the angels were really distraught. Why is this going on? It makes no sense. And God says, "Tach halav b'machshavah b'nai, this is my will, and I will not explain it." So God Himself does many things which we cannot rationalize or understand logically. And probably, this I heard from the Rav many times, he said that he felt that most of the great decisions or important decisions that people make in their lives are not rooted in logic, but are rooted in some other thing, in some inscrutable will or attraction. You have areas like marriage, which falls into that category, religion, career choices. Very few people do a very logical choice of their careers. Very few people sit down and make a rational investigation of, let's say, 100 different possible careers, take 5 different aptitude tests, have 5 or 10 sessions with counselors, then go out and try 15 different possibilities, and finally at the end logically conclude, you know, this is the career I want to do. Very, very few people do it that way. 99% of the world is choosing careers for some other reason. They just want to do this. They cannot explain why they make that choice. Where people live many times has nothing to do with logic, but just some kind of a desire or will to do that. And of course, values. Why do certain people have this value, that value? Why are some people more kind, and some people are more aggressive, and some people are bashful and shy, and other people are loud and brash and public. Why is that? You can't explain these things logically. These come from some other area in the personality. And if you think about it, it turns out that probably most of what people are thinking and doing and living is based upon this, what we call in Hebrew the ratzon, some will to do this. Not seichel, not based upon moach, on the mind, but rather based upon the lev. And perhaps we could say that the clash between the Greeks and the Jews was in this area, whereas the Greeks would like everything to be moach, logic. The Jews have a lev, the Jews have a ratzon. And according to Kabbalah and the Hasidic thinkers, who have a whole scheme of the world, a spiritual scheme, which involves certain concepts about God and theology as well as man, this will which guides and drives people, and is also a will and a driving force in the world outside people in the universe, is above, in terms of the scheme of things, the Kabbalistic scheme is above Chokhmah, is above wisdom. There's Chokhmah, Bina, V'Daat, which are 3 of the top concepts which the Hasidim Kabbalah work with, is below Ratzon. Ratzon is above that. And David HaMelech, David HaMelech represents the lady. David HaMelech is a man of tremendous emotion. He's not, maybe Shlomo HaMelech was Chacham Kol, he's logic, par excellence. But David HaMelech is emotion, is delayed. Libi tsari yirano kelchai. And when very interesting Gemara I read recently, that when Mashiach will come, there will be a big meal, you know, the Sfitach of Yatzah, and then at the end of the meal, the old Tzadikim will be sitting there, and there will be a question at the end of the meal, who's supposed to lead the Birchat HaMazon? So, maybe Abraham, maybe Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe Rabbeinu, but the decision is David HaMelech will be the one who will lead the Birchat HaMazon. He will get the greatest honor. Why is that so? The Gemara doesn't really explain it. However, according to this, we could say that Jewish commitment, when we get to Mashiach, it's a function of our commitment. How much have we stayed committed during this long sojourn to get there? And the commitment which we have is much more of a ratzon, of some kind of a will, rather than seichel, rather than logic. Logic many times will make us drop out. And whenever you've got, unfortunately, you meet someone who has dropped out, we give you very good logical reasons why he's dropped out. Very good logical reasons. Doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. There's this problem, that problem. So it's the ratzon, it's a certain illogical will which keeps the Jewish people going. An illogical will, which no one has been able to really break, because it's an illogical thing. If you can't really understand it, then it's really very hard to overcome it. If you understand why something is there, then maybe you could figure out, our enemies could figure out a method to get us to forsake this commitment. If it was only logical, they could do something. But if it's an illogical commitment, then it's almost basically indestructible. Since David HaMelech represents the lathe of Am Yisrael, because in all feelings it's about his lathe and his lifetimes connected to him and Am Yisrael, and the Rambam in fact brings down halacha that Melech is libo shel ha'am, the Melech is the lathe of the Am. So therefore, his commitment to Yahdut is really the commitment which is the basis of Emunah, and this keeps us going throughout the centuries, and that's why he gets the honor of being the mezamen at the Birchat HaMazon of Sudat Leviathan. So therefore, things like pogroms, inquisitions, holocausts, things which have largely sort of gone this way off, have not been successful. There are those of us who remain, and do so not for rewards, and not for some better life, but for some inscrutable will, some commitment which is beyond our life. It's just something we want to do. And that's what Emunah is. Emunah is this Ratzon Elyon. And this is the basis of Jewish commitment. And it's the basis of love in general. Ahava is Ratzon. Ratzon Elyon. It's not based on something which is so logical, but just something which you feel you have to do. It comes from some other place in the personality. Now the Greeks were focused on Teva. They were focused on natural law. You read Aristotle, his fundamental approach is that things, there's a natural law which we have to live by and understand and know and live by. A natural law is also supposed to be a logical law. And that's why, for example, Aristotle said that the world was eternal, sort of the world, because there's nothing in our experience which makes us see that the world is a yesh ma'ayin, that there was a fiat olam. We just see what we see. What exists is and continues to be, so therefore it probably was there in the past. And the laws of nature for him are immutable. And therefore nisim, they do not really accept the concept of miracles, which means things which break natural. However, the Torah says that nisim themselves are natural laws. That miracles are just God's will. And God wills that laws go a certain way. And then when one day God says that the law should go some other way, they work a different way. And Makot, and the nature of the Shemen. And therefore it turns out that according to the Torah point of view, even what we consider regular natural laws are really miracles. Because who says that the law which exists this second should continue next second? Maybe God will change his mind. So there is no such a thing for us of natural. Everything is a miracle. That's what the Ramban writes in Chumash many times. So everything is a miracle. Some miracles surprise me because they're infrequent. And some miracles I'm used to because they happen all the time. So therefore, this is the basis of all our brachot. Why do we make all these brachot every single day? Open up my eyes, give a blessing. So it's a miracle that my eyes see. Sometimes, God forbid, a person can open up his eyes in the morning, and in cases people just stop seeing. So every time I see, it's a miracle. If I can walk, it's a miracle. I say a blessing for walking. If I have clothing, it's a miracle. I mean, everything which happens to the Jew is a miracle. There's no such thing as something natural, it has to be. Everything is in a certain way a surprise. Even things like bread, Hamotzi Lechem in the Aretz, I thank God for bread. Everything is from a Kodesh Baruch. That's why we say in Dan, M'chadesh, B'tuvot, Tamid, Ma'asei B'reishit. B'chol Yom, Tamid, Ma'asei B'reishit. God, every second of the day is actually making creation. Creation is an ongoing process. Chanukah, the mace of Chanukah is, according to many of the writers, is another Biyat Olam, because by Chanukah, by the fact that the miracle was one thing, but the fact that the miracle showed that God is in continuous control of nature, so therefore we are re-experiencing because of Chanukah the creation of the world. Because it makes us much more aware of that reality is not constant. Reality is something which has continuous divine will. So in everything we see, the Jew sees God at every place. He sees him in the sun, and in the rain, and the wind. He sees him in the trees. He sees God in the air, in my body, in my thoughts, and everything which we do. Everything is Baruch Atah Hashem. There's no such a thing as separation from God. God is in every fiber of my experience. And everything is God's will. So it's a completely different perspective than the Hellenistic perspective of the world. Even though both have a lot of wisdom in it, but it's a completely different way of approaching the world. And we might be able to say that if the Hellenist sees the outside of things, the Torah scholar sees the inside or the hidden part of things. Chitzoniyut versus Pnimiyut. And this reminds me of an interesting point that the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, once said. He asked a very interesting question. Why is it that the Greek culture, Greek art, emphasized the body? Statues, other things, plays, and Judaism is very much not to show off the body. Judaism is very much into tzniut. He said that the difference is because since Hellenism appreciates the external view of things, so the external view of the bodies is very impressive, it's very beautiful, especially it's apparent. Well, by person, so it's a beautiful thing to look at. And if they would reveal a beautiful body. But Judaism, on the other hand, appreciates the hidden part, what we don't really see on the external side of things. So therefore, Judaism appreciates the holiness, the kedusha, which is within the body. And that makes the body itself holy, because clean, which has to be shot in it, becomes itself kadosh. And something which is holy, special, we protect, we cover. We don't show it. It's hidden. Kedusha is hidden. For example, as you go into Yerushalayim, the more and more kadosh you get, the more hidden you go through the walls to get into Yerushalayim, to the Beit Hamikdash, another wall. And higher and higher on, kedusha, another wall, another fence, another another curtain. The Kodesh Kodashim is the most hidden place, because the more Kadosh, the more it's hidden. So therefore, since human being is basically a tabakot of something very holy, so it should be hidden. Hidden means it should be covered, like we cover the sacred Torah. Another very interesting thing which comes out of this different views of the world. The Greeks believe very much in fate, that things have to happen a certain way, because if a person is given a certain amount of potential and ability in the situation which he's put into, so his fate has basically determined what will happen to him within a certain parameter in which he can vary and then adjust. But the Greeks never believed that you could create something from nothing. You had to just take what you're given, what you have, and develop it this way or that way. But if you can't do more than what you start off with, whereas Judaism believes the man can totally change. A coward, according to Judaism, can become a brave hero. And a fool can become a scholar. And a wicked person can become a saint. So someone like Nebuzaradan, the general of Nebuchadnezzar, who killed hundreds of thousands of people, at one point became disgusted and whatever, he saw something happen in the Beit HaMikdash, which impressed him very much. And he did tshuva, Gemara says, and he became a Ger Tzedek. And from him came Reb Meir, one of the greatest scholars that we ever had. Because even someone who's a mass murderer, I remember when I was a young child, people used to ask me, what would happen if Hitler, Yimach Shemo, would have done tshuva? Would Judaism forgive him? Would you forgive him? And we only have a story in the Gemara. It was a Radan, who was Nebuchadnezzar's commander-in-chief, and he himself was the person responsible for hundreds of thousands of Jews and many millions of other people. And he did tshuva. We accepted him as a Ger Tzedek. We would accept even a mass murderer could do tshuva, if it's a true tshuva, because we can truly repent. So these things are illogical. We can't say that it's very logical that you take a mass murderer and he commits, he does tshuva, and we accept him, we forgive him, or they start afresh. It's a very illogical system. But it's something which has to do with something above logic. It's a higher wisdom called Chochma Elyona, which is parallel to the Ratzon Elyona. And therefore, the logic of the Torah is not two values to enforce, but it's multivariate. It has many, many values in it. Partially true, partially false, true and false, and so on and so forth. A completely different logic. It takes nothing like Shabbos. We know from our traditions that the Jews were persecuted by the Greeks for keeping Shabbat. And it was a very illogical thing. Why would you want to keep Shabbat? Why would you want to stop working one day a week? You can be productive, work 7 days a week after what you get to produce. And Ad Hayom Hazeh, basic economic theory, is based upon this Greek notion that a person will work to maximize his income. The basic theory of labor is that if you can make more money, you'll work more. But we know it's not true. People don't do that. People don't work to maximize their profits. People are not as logical as the Greeks wanted us to be, or as Adam Smith thought that we were. Remember, I once read, and some economist noticed this. He was shopping on the Lower East Side, and he went into a Jewish grocery. I think Titsky, is that the grocery on the Lower East Side? I forgot the name. Anyway, he went to this Jewish grocery. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He said, "It's a big side cheese, lots of cheeses." He put himself some cheeses and walked in. It's locked. Closed. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the grocery is closed. Didn't make any sense then. It's the middle of the day. So he asked some people on the street, "What's going on? How come the grocery is all of a sudden closed in the middle of the day?" So, "Don't you know? Every day from 1 to 1:15, this grocery is closed because they're doing the afternoon trade. The local Jewish merchants all close their stores and go into this guy's grocery and lock the door, and they're praying mincha." So this fellow wrote an article in the New York Times. We have to readjust our theory of economics because people aren't working to maximize profits. Other considerations are coming into the business. He's not doing business because he wants to die. It's a different reason. He's not doing what Adam Smith said. He's not doing what the Greeks said, that you work in order to produce the maximum value. I had myself, few of my talmidim over the years, I'm already becoming an old man, so I can speak about the years, became millionaires at very young age, before the age of 30. They were millionaires. And so I was wondering, what do they do? Some people I know who became millionaires, they say, okay, I'm a millionaire, that doesn't make me $100 million, $200 million, $500 million. So they keep on working. But these three people, different times, different situations, each of them basically retired before the age of 30, and they were learning and babbling here and there. They got, everybody of course wanted to make deals with them, of course these people are money. So people always call them this deal, that deal, and they listen, and once in a while they would maybe nibble at it, and once in a very great while they take a bite. But they weren't really working. And for years and years these fellows were sitting and learning in the basement and doing a little business here. They're spending a lot of time with their family. And going against all the theory of economics, which says you're supposed to maximize, suppose what Bill Gates did. After you make the first million, go for the 100 million, the billion, the 46 billion, and you keep on working. Why should we stop you? Just maximize what you have. But this is not the logic of the Torah. The logic of the Torah is that something like wealth, wealth is not a value unto itself. It's not a goal unto itself. Wealth is only a tool, the Torah says, for something more important, whether it's time spent with your family, whether it's to free you to be able to sit and study Torah and maybe dedicate your life to doing mitzvahs, like I remember reading about Moses Montefiore. Moses Montefiore was a very wealthy English Jew, but at some point, at a pretty young age, I think he was in his 30s, he said, I've made enough money in business, let other people run my businesses, now I'm just going to dedicate the rest of my life to helping Jews around the world. And he went all around the world. He went to Russia, the drums, and Pope, and Israel, and he basically financed and economically and was very critical politically in getting the whole concept of the Jewish resettlement of Israel off the ground. He's a man in the 30s, 40s, who just basically stopped business and said, I'm going to dedicate myself to more important things. So wealth, for us, is not an end unto itself. It's just a means of getting someplace. And many times we should say no to opportunities. I always tell, for example, students. The students talk to me, I know that in the last 20 years, the fellows were all the main first thing that come to colleges, you want to become either a lawyer or a doctor. So I have a couple of people I noticed in the audience who are doctors, so I don't want to be careful what I say. But the thing is that you have to take it into account. What about all the years, all the effort? What are you going to do with it? You know, is it worth it? It's not just a question of doctor or lawyer that makes more money than, I don't know, plumber. I don't know if that's true, but maybe it used to be true. Now it's not so true. So whatever, or a school teacher, that's for sure. Doctors always are better than a school teacher. So fine, so you say, from an economic point of view, that's the career. But there are many other things that I would say as a rabbi that you want to take into account. Time, for example, with a woman, I think personally, maybe I'm wrong, but, we're going to have a little workshop afterwards, maybe you want to discuss this and some other things. But I personally think that a woman is better off as a teacher than as a doctor, because I think as a teacher she has 2 or 3 months a year off in the summertime. So it's wonderful time to spend with the family. Every day she finishes teaching about 3-4 o'clock. She'll be home 5 o'clock. And basically, kids come home from school, so she's already home. So other professions, yeah, lawyer, women lawyers, lawyers are not staying in the office usually until 8-9 o'clock for many years. You know, that's the best profession for women to go into, even though financially maybe it's better. But there's other considerations you want to take into account when you make a choice of a career. Not just how much money is this career going to give me, but other things in financial. Even though prestige, yes, there's much more prestige for the legal and medical profession than there is to be a teacher, especially a yeshiva teacher. It's not prestigious at all. So you have less prestige, but you have other benefits. So I think that Judaism is saying that many, many other factors, maybe not even the most logical of factors, go into making important decisions. And it turns out that because we're dealing with something which are not what we call such mercantile or everyday logic, but we're applying some kind of higher, what we call higher, maybe people would feel like disagree with us, but what we think is a higher form of making decisions, approaching life. So it turns out that we make different kinds of decisions, and I think that in the long run, in many cases, it turns out better decisions. Better decisions. So take something, for example, like marriage and divorce. Nowadays, I mean, of course, we know that the non-Jewish world a long time ago decided that divorce should be very easy. And today, I don't even know how much marriage exists anymore as an institution. But Judaism traditionally was very, was frowned upon quick and easy divorces. There's a law that when the couple comes to the Beit Din, the Beit Din has to try very hard to try to slow it down and try to get it to be considered and to keep going. Just the traditional approach. Maybe from a logical point of view, it's not so reasonable. People are suffering, and people are not so happy, people are frustrated, they're not fulfilling what they think they should do. On the other hand, being more loyal to a commitment has benefits. So it's better for the family. The fact that a family usually, I mean in a general sense, of course every case is different, but in a general sense it's better for children if the parents are married. It's not the best marriage overall. It is better for the children. There's a certain amount of stability which every person has, even if they have not the greatest partner, but so if it's a partner. So there are things which are there which give benefits in some other ways, not necessarily the immediate gratification or the immediate well-being that people very much want to have nowadays. So, in many ways, the Chacham of Torah makes us think and decide about things completely differently than Greek and everyday mercantile logic. And this is the foundation of Chanukah. Chanukah, for example, the family unit is a very important thing in Judaism. It's not something to be dealt with, you know, very lightly. It's a very, very critical element because Chanukah, we say Nerishu Beis, so you light the candles with the family. Who actually created the whole revolution and the struggle was a single family. A Hashemite, one family, they did it. So for us the family is very important. And we do a lot, we want to do a lot to preserve the family. And for us a family is a holy institution. It's something which has a super logic. Not simple logic, but it's something which has to be read some. And that, I think, is also a very important part as we go through life and in families, we're bound to have many, many obstacles, many struggles, many disappointments, downs as well as ups. And it's the illogical commitment, it's the read some, to keep that family going, which is a strong element in the strength of the Jewish family. There's a blind will to keep it going. I know people go through various crises, even if it's not objective, but there's going to be times, there's going to be financial strains, it's almost always going to happen, someplace along the way. People go through midlife crises where, I don't know, I'm not a psychologist, but I think it's a very common thing, especially with men. Men sometime around the age of 40, and I'm 55, so I can really look back at it in history. But at the age of 40, and that typical man goes through a very grave crisis. He thinks his life was a waste,
can never accomplish anything. He's not this, he's not that, everything's stupid. And I don't know, something's going crazy, the cervical sinus drain. And it could be disastrous in such a situation. A crisis like that, which is some kind of deep crisis, you have to have a commitment, which is beyond logic. Logic at that age says, dump everything, divorce your wife, walk out of the kids, get a new career, go to a different country, start life all over again. And unfortunately, there are people who succumb to this. There are people who succumb to it, both men and women, around the age of 40. They just, something snaps inside. They want to start all over again. But if you have a ratzon el yom, some kind of a blind commitment, you'll stick it through, and you'll come back, and at the end of whatever the zman it takes to go through this particular crisis, you'll come out of it either changing your career, but in a nice, logical way, or staying with the same career. Hopefully you stay with your wife and the family, 99% I would hope of the time, and go on, something bigger and better. But there has to be a commitment. I just saw today actually in the Sefer Shemesh Shmuel discussing Yosef in this week's parasha. Yosef is called the Tzaddik. We have to understand that not only was he 22 years away from his family, he spent 10 years in a dungeon. 10 years in a dungeon in Egypt. No hope whatsoever ever getting out. No hope whatsoever. I mean, a logical hope. But when you read the story of Yosef, you never see Yosef veering from his values or veering from his commitments. The Zohar says that while he was in the dungeon, he went through depression. He was atzuf, which is, I guess, the classical word for depression. He was in a depression. Because he thought that was it, he would never get out. Something snapped. And he still kept the commitment to the values of his household, of Yaakov, and whenever he spoke, God's name was on his lips, as the commentaries point out. He always says that came beyond that, no matter what. He keeps the commitment no matter what the circumstance. This is so elegant. This is a higher level of commitment. So, this is a very important part of the claim. Another very important part is the question of midot. I just want to explain something very interesting. The question is, how could something so beautiful like Greek philosophy and art and culture become, at least for us, so violent, turn so violent, like say, oh, when you read the sources, did you put on a pair of tefillin so they would kill him? Did the smila certainly would kill him, the baby? How did it become so violent? But maybe the same question is, maybe I'm wrong for making a comparison, but there's a comparison. How could Nazi Germany? Germans were also very advanced scientifically and philosophically and culturally. What happened over there? So there's a theory which I would like to propose. In the Shemesh Shmuel, he says that being very wise and cultured, which is a wonderful thing in its own right, has its own danger. What is the danger? The danger is that the person who is brighter than others and is smarter than others and knows more than others feels that he is superior to others. It feeds a sense of superiority. And a sense of superiority, if I'm superior, then the other person is inferior. And then, maybe another step or two beyond that, I have a right then to dominate this other person, because I'm more superior to them. And this certainly was part of the Greek drive to dominate the world. What was their drive to dominate the world? Because they wanted to bring enlightenment to the world. Make the world a better place, but people aren't going to listen to us. So the only way to make them listen
is to conquer. So if I conquer them, then I can spread my culture. So I'm much kind of thinking that if you just a little sensitive, it exists, for example, in America very much. I mean, if I was an Arab, not that I'm an ally, the Arabs happen to be anti-Saddam Hussein, but I can understand when he says in the bunker yesterday in the radio, it's quoted him saying, oh, these Americans, they only fight by pushing buttons from long range and throwing technology at me. Why don't they come here like real people and fight me man to man? What he's saying is, what gives the United States, which is 3,000-5,000 miles away, the right to be my policeman? Just because you have technology so you can push buttons and throw missiles at me from 1,000 miles away gives you the right to be my policeman. I never asked to be my policeman. So, there is something, there is an element of truth to that. Not that I accept with his argument, but there's an element of truth to the fact that people who have advanced knowledge feel that they have the right to impose their views and opinions on others because we have advanced knowledge, apparently we're superior to them. It breeds a sense of superiority, of gaiva. If it goes too far, then it could lead to anything. It could lead to colonialism and imperialism and oppression and, God forbid, Nazism. Because you just go further and further with this meat of guy, the thing that I'm really special for you. And after a while, it can turn into the fact that everybody else in the world is inferior to us, and we can step on them. What was the whole colonial movement of the English and the French and the Europeans in Asia and Africa? What were they saying? Since our society is much more advanced, how did we define being advanced? We have better science. Basically, we can make better machines. We understand more about the world, so therefore we are more advanced, and therefore we can impose our civilization on the natives, whether it's India or Africa or Asia. It's a certain kind of gaiva which develops. And it's a very natural phenomenon for people who are very good and with their minds to think that they are superior to others. And that's really what was going on, I think. That's when the Antiochus. See, if you read the original Socrates, at least as Plato records him, he was a very modest man. He says, a lot of things I don't know. So, of course, he saw he didn't know many. He said, I know a lot of things, a lot of things I don't know. So he was humbled by the fact that he didn't understand certain things. Rather than looking at what he did know to make him proud, he looked at what he didn't know to make him humble. And probably when Shimon HaTzadik met Alexander and Aristotle, so there was a humbleness on the Greek side, and they were impressed with the wisdom that the Jews had. We have in the Talmud other occasions of discourses and disputes and back and forth with the Greeks and the rabbis, because there was a mutual respect based upon humbleness. Maybe the other side knows something that I don't know. Maybe I can learn from them something. When you come one or two generations later, Antiochus, Greek Syrian culture, a couple of generations later, they don't want to learn anything anymore. They know it. And they want to impose what they know on the Jews. That's the difference. When it moves from humbleness into arrogance. That's the difference. But knowledge can breed humbleness if a person focuses on what he doesn't know. But it also breed arrogance if he thinks he knows everything. So, the Judaism has the same problem. You shouldn't deny the fact that Judaism has the same problem, because there are enough people who, in Judaism, enough Jews who think that we're superior to everybody else, and even though this particular Jew may not be superior because he has many many failings in morality and personal life and even in his wisdom, he doesn't know as much as he thinks he does, but he thinks he's superior to everybody else in the world. It's the danger. So the danger of gaiva is a tremendous danger. In fact, the Kutzker Rebbe said that the two big Yetzer Hara, there are two big major dangers to the human being in this world. One is the Yetzer Hara of Tava. People have a tremendous desire for physical pleasure. If you don't control it, it can destroy. If we don't control our desire for physical pleasure in some way, we'll be destroyed. As we see the United States presidency, for example. But many times, you have to be able to know when to say no, put limits on my seeking of pleasure. And Judaism focuses on that, but even within Judaism we have to work on that. Then beyond that, there's another tremendous danger to the human being's spiritual level, And that's the danger of arrogance. Arrogance is a vice of the mind and the soul, not of the flesh. Whereas ta'avat ha'guf is a vice of the flesh. It's a lower level problem. But the problem of arrogance is a tremendously deep problem, because a human being has a tremendous desire to be arrogant and proud. And the Pesukim Rebbe says, is that as a person controls his desires of the flesh, he becomes more arrogant, because he's more impressed with himself. Look, I was able to fast Monday and Thursday. No one else fasted. I was able to do it voluntarily. So he becomes arrogant. Or I was able to sit in the base of Medrash for 10 hours and the other boys only sat for 6 hours. Or I was able to raise $10,000 to help a poor person for an operation, and everybody else only raised at most $1,000. That makes me arrogant. It's a natural reaction to doing good things. A person feels proud. And that's a tremendously difficult vice to overcome, because doing good things makes me more proud of myself. So how am I supposed to overcome this? Which is really the, in our level, we're not discussing, God forbid, the Greek or, God forbid, the Nazi level arrogance, but we're talking about the Jewish arrogance. And Jewish arrogance is very harmful, not just for the individual, it's harmful for the Jewish people, because a lot of other nations resent the fact that Jews are arrogant, they say. And sometimes we are. Because we think we know so much, and maybe we do know a lot, maybe we know more than others. But we shouldn't be arrogant. So how does one fight this? So you say like this, you have two approaches. One approach is that a person can try to knock themselves down. A person can start looking at their own failings. This is wrong with me, and that's wrong with me, and therefore I shouldn't be so proud of myself. That is a method, but that's not the best method, because it's a very dangerous method. A person starts knocking themselves, they could become depressed, and a person could lose self-confidence and turn into a weakling. He should not be a weakling. He turn into someone who's afraid of things, because we can't do this, we can't do that, and this is wrong with him, that's wrong with him. So be afraid of challenges. Judaism doesn't want a person to be afraid of life's challenges. So that's not the best approach, to try to find flaws in myself. I should be happy with myself. I should be proud of what I can do. But the way to keep it in control and the way to keep it in balance is by looking at the greatness of your Ribono Shel Olam. Look at the greatness of God. I see how wonderful God is. How stupendous he is. How much he gives me. How much he does for the world. Then I put myself into the, I hope, in the right place. Because compared to God, I'm what I am, but I'm not God. So the more person focuses on the godless of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the godless of the Borei Olam, the more a person will be an unov in the right midah, a right kind of humbleness. It's a humbleness which will give a person the confidence to do the right things, because his commitments will be commitments of Torah and Kedusha, not just pride and arrogance. It will be something which he has confidence, because he's working together with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shavis Hashem, the Neg Yisamid, is the true way for a person to achieve the right measure of pride versus humility. So, one way of finding out if we are really arrogant or humble is if we ever lose our temper. Because when there's chaos, anytime a person loses his temper or her temper, that's a sign that there is a certain measure of arrogance we shouldn't be there. It's absolutely, Gemara says, kol ha'kores, kilo over the avodah zarah. And then even one time, Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the Rambam, was punished by not going into Eretz Yisrael. The greatest punishment of his life was he got angry at the rock. If he wouldn't have gotten angry, he would have been fine. Hitting the rock was not the problem, the Rambam says. He was lying to hit the rock, whatever he said. The problem was because he got angry, and he wasn't supposed to get angry. That's what he lost. He blew it. Because anger means that there's a certain amount of pride which I'm trying to protect. Something in me which was hurt means my pride, I was insulted, and my defense is anger. My defense is anger. Where does this pride come from? Why should I be proud? God has a lot of patience, so let me have God's patience. God's patience is infinite. God could be angry, who knows how much, if he wanted to, with what people do. every person does. He has infinite patience. He waits. He doesn't respond. He gives a beautiful little book, which I recommend everybody read, called Tomei of Devora, the Palm Tree of Devora, written by Rabbi Moshe Kodavoro. He explains in a very short little book, but beautifully written, to explain, to just illustrate God's patience. How God is so infinitely patient with people. Infinitely patient. I mean, with worse people, still gives them food, still gives them air, still gives them water, gives them clothing, lets them live, let them do what they want, because he's waiting. Maybe they will change. Maybe they'll do good. And God's patience is what I have to learn from. And if I have God with me all the time, so then I will be patient too. I will not have any chaos. So chaos is a telltale sign of Gaiva. There's a story of the Mishnah Tzarebi. The Mishnah Tzarebi was once at the matzah bakery, and of course the Rebbe was there, so the managers were very, very tense. The Rebbe's here, we have to be really super kosher. And I don't know, somebody, one of the workers was carrying a little flour in a jar and stumbled, and the flour spilled. And the manager got so angry, he started screaming at him, "You dare spill some flour over here, don't you know? It could become chametz, what's going on?" Mr. Rebbe went over to the manager, says, "Excuse me," says, "Why did he get so angry at this Jew?" He says, "Well, you know, he's spilling flour, it's chametz possible, it's matzah, what's going on?" Mr. Rebbe says, "You know, I don't know if I can eat these matzahs now, not because I'm worrying about the chametz, because a little chametz is a small problem, but a little kas is a tremendous problem. And I see that you as a manager have kas. I don't want to have any kas in my matzahs. I don't want my matzahs baked with kas. A little kas is more of a problem for me in my matzah than a little chametz. So therefore, I don't know if I'm going to use these matzahs this year. Maybe I'll go to someone else's matzahs. Because a little kas is worse than anything else." The story of Nachum Mendel, Baba Cherebi. So he, the son was making a trip. He sent him a letter to his father. He says, "Father, you know, wherever I go, I get a tremendous honor, because I'm your son. It's really amazing. You're so beloved by all the Hasidim throughout Russia." So when he came back and spoke to his father, he says, "You know, your letter really upset me. I was crying when I read the letter." He says, "Why are you crying?" He says, "I want to tell you a story. There was once a king, and the king just wanted to see what it meant. I mean, generally, he wanted to see what's going on with his subjects, and he didn't want them to know he's the king. So he took one of his guards and he said, 'Listen, let's trade positions. You get dressed up like me, and I'll get dressed up like you. We'll go to a little village and let's get out and let's see how they treat you and how they treat me. This, I want to get to know the temperament of my subjects.' So they get into the royal carriage and they drive 100 miles, they go to a little village, and they come out, and the guard / real king gets out first and holds the door, and the king / real soldier, wearing a crown and whatever, dressed up beautifully, and he comes out, and people, the king is coming into the village, so people are all there. Everybody's bowing down to the king, and the king is crying. The king is crying. So one of the people goes over to him and says, "Your Majesty, why are you crying?" He says, "Because I'm not the real king. The soldier is the king. And because you're bowing to me, you're embarrassing the king." Everyone got very confused, and the soldier king was crying because he was all upset because this paradoxical situation was developing with him at the center. So Baba Cherebi says, "You know, it's the same thing. You're telling me in the letter how people give me so much honor, but I'm only a soldier walking with the king. We're the honor for the king. Why am I getting all this honor? The king should be getting the honor. If you walk with him, then you don't need this honor, which people give to other people." So that's the kind of humbleness which Judaism promotes. every person, we say Nala Nisim, Rav Melech Rabin gave Rabin Biat Ma'atim Tmei Batom Rishon Biat Tzadikim. Zayin Nadeskeser Secha. So this is an external clash, but there's also an internal clash. We have within us the same kind of struggle. We have within us this, the commitment to Judaism, which is maybe it seems on a logical level a very small thing, but it has to dominate. It has to dominate. The part of us which is Torah has to come out and dominate the part which is Tameh. So the Nes of Hanukkah, the miracle of Hanukkah, gives us a tremendously new encouragement in the middle of a winter. You know, this year it's not much of a winter, but usually it would be snow outside. This winter, which is a mild winter, but still, it's still about 2 months since Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and the inspiration of that season is faded, and we need a new inspiration. The inspiration of Hanukkah is that despite the odds, despite the logical odds against every one of us in our personal lives, whether it's in our moral situation, ethical situation, our careers, in our family, and so on and so forth, whatever the odds are, we should never give up hope. We should never become helpless and hopeless. We do not allow logic, mercantile logic, to throw us off our commitments and our faith. And we know that we have belief because God is with us in every step along the way. Life is just miracles after miracles. That's all life is. And the patience which we need between these miracles become apparent to us. Is something which we should live with and always have. And we should be zocher through the inspiration of the Hanukkah season and the messages of Hanukkah to be able to live better lives this year and forever. And be zocher for another Geulah. B'mehar v'mehar, amen.